Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. This week, we're going to talk about big tech and the news.
Meta is threatening to remove news content on Facebook and Instagram in California.
Google saying it plans to block Canadian news.
Facebook has blocked all news pages in Australia.
Google says some California residents will no longer see California-based news websites in their searches as it takes a stance against legislation making its way through Sacramento.
What you just heard are artifacts of the ongoing standoff between Meta, Google, and the news industry, and I wanted to do a bit of a deep dive this weekend on it. So we're bringing back our audio reporter, Rebecca Rand. Good to see you, Rebecca.
Good to see you too, Justin.
For new listeners, Rebecca was our audio intern last summer. She's just finished her master's at CUNY's Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism. And then what's next for you? What's that face?
I'm about to graduate from journalism school after several months of massive media layoffs phase.
I do not envy the position you or any of your classmates are in right now. That's something that's related to what we're going to talk about on the show today. So let's start there. Why don't you tell me a bit about what it's been like for you and your classmates coming out of the program?
Yeah, sure. So we started hearing about these layoffs in my second semester of J school. It was winter, moving into spring 2023, and my classmates and I think we were in denial at first, like, oh, it's just a fluke. But then it was one after another.
More media job cuts.
After another.
BuzzFeed is closing.
The Messenger. Vox is now laying off staff across its business.
Chicago Public Radio. Forbes.
Cuts at Vice News.
Are really wiping out right now, and it's tough in old legacy media, too.
Major layoffs at the LA Times.
Laid off nearly a quarter of its newsroom.
New York Public Radio.
News Corp.
The Washington Post.
NPR.
Condé Nast.
Insider.
Paramount Global.
Cuts at Sports Illustrated, Time, and National Geographic.
The Texas Tribune, The Athletic, and on and on and on.
Wow, so you're halfway through J school. This starts happening. Did you regret your decision to go back to school?
Well, I've definitely wondered if it was the right choice, but there wasn't really a good alternative. I went to grad school because it's really hard to get an entry-level job of any kind these days without existing experience or connections. It's annoying, but it's true. And it's largely true for journalism, at least the kind of long-form reporting I want to do. Maybe in the old days I could have cut my teeth at a local paper, but I don't know if you've heard, there aren't many of those left anymore.
That's right. I guess maybe you could have struck out on your own. I mean, you have considered freelancing, starting your own podcast.
Justin, if I had a dollar for every time one of my relatives said, just write a blog, anyone can start a podcast, I'd be... Well, okay, I wouldn't be rich, but I'd have like $20. It's not that easy. And please do not tell any of my future employers this, or they'll think I'm not a self-starter or whatever.
I think, unfortunately, we may be telling a few people about this right now, but having watched you work at Tech Policy Press last summer, I can say you are absolutely a self-starter.
Thank you, Justin. But, you know, I guess that's part of the point. It's a lot easier to be a self-starter when you're starting from somewhere. School seemed like a really good way to make sure I learned how to do things right. It's sort of a fast track to get a bunch of really high quality clips. And I did great. I got published in my second month of school. And now I'm more skilled than ever. But now as I'm about to graduate, jobs are really scarce. And the job market is really competitive. And that was always true, but it's even worse now. Like, at my school in the past, at least the business journalism kids could pretty much count on getting jobs after graduating, like 90% of them. I actually spoke to the head of the business journalism program, and he told me that this year, his job placement rate for his cohort is half that, or even less than half that if you're talking about permanent, full-time positions. You know, I have so many bright, talented colleagues, and we're all really stressed out. You know, none of us got into this to, like, make tons of money. We just want enough to, like, you know, live.
Well, I can certainly tell you, having worked in this industry for a bit, that it is not a great place to get rich. And as someone who has started, you know, of course, a nonprofit, a media organization myself, I can tell you it's not easy to do either. Tech Policy Press relies on philanthropy and donations from readers. And that's it's a hard road. You know, unfortunately, I don't think at scale, no matter how much the wonderful philanthropists that do invest in projects like this one and so many others put into the pot, it's still not going to correct the dynamic that you're talking about. But this isn't the first time we've heard that journalism is dead or dying.
No, it's not.
So what do you regard as new this time from your perspective?
I mean, you're right. Honestly, not much is really new. And that's kind of the problem. It's like a few extra wounds in this death by a thousand cuts process for the news. Media companies are saying that the past year or so have been especially bad due to changes in search algorithms and social media platforms that are reducing traffic to news sites. And overall, I would say the media is grappling with, and has been grappling with this for decades now, the issue of finding a sustainable business model. Part of that is we don't know how to get people to pay for news online. Some publications like the New York Times have managed to convince people to pay, but other organizations either rely on big charitable donations. These are your nonprofit newsrooms like ProPublica or you. And some countries have really robust public media, which gets government funding. We used to have that here in the U.S. to a certain extent, but that funding was slashed by Congress decades ago. And another way to get paid for news is by hosting ads on your website. And all of these strategies have their own benefits and drawbacks.
Well, certainly this debate about how to make journalism viable has been going around and around in circles for many years. It's been a long time since I remember folks like Clay Shirky writing essays that, you know, really kind of framed up the challenge. So many reports, so many white papers, so many convenings that I've participated in and that, you know, many others around the CUNY Journalism School have participated in over the last two decades.
Totally.
So in the diagnosis of what's wrong with journalism, a lot of folks point the finger at big tech.
It's always big tech. All right, tell me more. What have they done this time?
So there's a growing acknowledgement, and you see it in lots of legislatures, lots of governments around the world, that big tech has too much power over the media industry and over journalism in particular, which is not surprising since the biggest place people are getting their news these days is online. We know tech is embedded in every corner of the internet, where people find the news, where people share the news, where people buy news subscriptions, and of course, advertising.
Yeah, I mean, if you're online, big tech is going to be either making money off of you or asking you for money in some way.
That's right. So there's been a recent push to look into the ways that big tech wields this power in the market. Also, how the companies have used that power to develop products that would be impossible without news. This process has left the media both financially strapped and still totally dependent on big tech to make what little money they can. And a lot of folks, myself included, regard it as market failure.
Hooray!
So I recently moderated a kind of fireside chat with two really smart people who are thinking about these issues, digging into the idea about what should be done. How can we possibly move billions of dollars back towards news gathering? How can we reformulate the market in a way that makes journalism sustainable?
Right.
So one of the scholars who was part of the conversation is Anya Shiffrin.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm really glad to be here. I think that we all know what the problems are. Since I teach at Columbia, I'd like to be cheerful. And so I really focus on what are the solutions.
So Anya and I have taught together for some years. She runs the Tech, Media, and Communication Specialization at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. And then the Fireside Chat was hosted by the Knight Foundation. And I think Knight brought her in because she recently published a paper that calculates how much value the existence of journalism online actually generates for big tech companies like Meta and Google.
You know, I guess I'd never considered the idea that maybe big tech actually benefits from the existence of news online. I guess I always thought of it in reverse. So how does that happen?
It's all based around this idea that news and products like Google are essentially complementary services, at least from the user's point of view.
What's a complementary service?
Well, to explain it this way, I want you to imagine what would happen to the news if there was no Google.
I mean, I think at least what media companies are saying right now is that a lot fewer people would end up reading the news. Like, a big way people end up on news sites is that journalism has the answer to a question that people type into the search bar.
Right. So we've known that for a long time. But now think about it in reverse. What would happen if the news disappeared from Google search?
Yikes. I mean, all I can think of is that it would be replaced by this sort of toxic cesspool of AI-generated, search engine-optimized articles that don't really answer your question and then try to sell you something.
Exactly. This is what I mean by complementary. Journalism benefits big companies like Google because it brings high-quality information to the platform. Information that keeps users engaged and coming back, and Google makes money off that. And the news benefits from all this because it gets readers.
Well, hold on a second. Because now Google is doing this thing where instead of directing users to the article in the search results, they're actually using AI to generate a summary of the answer at the top of the search results. So people never actually visit the news site. So the news site doesn't get the reader, which means they don't get the advertising money or the potential subscriber.
So that's exactly the issue. And it's just the tip of the iceberg. Google, other tech platforms are actually doing all sorts of different types of reformulations, editing, various automated mechanisms to change the way that information is portrayed. And, you know, a lot of that has a high value for users, particularly in a search context. But I'm going to turn it over to Anya because she has a great metaphor for this.
Imagine you have a beautiful bakery and you sell really delicious muffins with crusty blueberries on top. And every single day, somebody comes and takes the top of the muffin, leaves you the little dry bit, and then you can't sell it. And they say, oh, you need a new business model.
Okay, so in this metaphor, like, the information in the news article is the muffin top?
Correct.
And Google is kind of stealing it?
That's what Anya says.
So that's basically what's happened, right? The platforms, Google search benefits from all the people that need some information. They see the news of the day, and then they don't click through to any news site. That's part of what's happening. What our paper is based on, this whole question of how do you split the surplus value, right? So a friend of mine, this literally happened 3 weeks ago. She called me up and she says, I'm ready to go to an assisted living. I think my apartment's worth $2 million. My neighbor's apartment's worth $4 million. She wants to buy my apartment, and I looked online, and I think that the combined apartment is actually worth $15 million. That's a $9 million surplus. How do we split it? And I thought, well, I can't believe you're asking this question, because I've been working with these economists all year. There is economic theory dating back since the 1950s that you have to split this in half.
Half. Okay, so just to make sure I'm understanding, together, Google and news, the whole apartment that they have together is worth more than the sum of its parts.
Essentially.
Except, like, now Google is taking more than its share of the profit from the apartment, which Anya thinks should be at least closer to half.
That's right.
Okay, so is this just like a way to point the finger at big tech and say, you're unfair? What does Anya think we can actually do with this information?
So back in 2020, Anya started to pay attention to legislation brewing in Australia, where the government decided it wanted to help news companies negotiate with big tech companies. And this idea wasn't totally unheard of. Here's what Anya said.
And I was intrigued by that because so many countries over so many years had tried to get licensing payments and copyright payments and hadn't succeeded.
So what happened with these other countries?
Well, Spain is one example she talked about. So back in 2014, the Spanish government wanted Google to pay licensing fees into a pool that it would distribute back to news organizations. Anya says that didn't go well.
Guess what happened? Google dropped Spanish news for 8 years.
They dropped They what?
They got rid of Google News in Spain.
Because they didn't want to pay?
Correct. So, you know, at the top of the episode, the montage we heard of Google and Facebook blocking news?
Yeah.
So that's what these tech companies do if you ask them to pay to feature your content. They just say, fine, we'll stop featuring your content.
Hmm. But if we believe what Anya's saying, isn't that like a bad business decision for them?
According to Anya, yes, in the long run, it would be a bad decision, but maybe less so for Meta than for Google. But most experts I talk to say this is just a bargaining tactic, not a business move ultimately.
Hmm, I see. Actually, can you explain a little bit the difference between Meta and Google here?
Well, it's really easy to see how Google benefits from the news. It's a little harder with Meta. It's not like most people are using Meta primarily to find news and information.
Mm.
But Anya would argue that Meta still makes money off of news content in two ways. One, it keeps users engaged. And two, every time users show interest in something, like a news article, that's useful data that Meta can use or sell.
Mm, got it. Still, it sounds like these companies would rather we think that they don't need the news.
That's right. And here's what Anya says, specifically about Google.
Google is dealing with the threat of legislation in three ways. They're going to governments and saying, we're going to drop all your country's news from search. They are spending a fortune on lobbyists. And then they're basically just handing out money to publishers. They're making everyone sign NDAs. And the amounts they're handing out are absolutely pitiful. Google is going to publishers in all these low-income countries. And they're saying, yeah, I'll pay you $20,000.
And just to press you on that, that's an estimate of the economic value that news publishers create for those.
Yeah, what they did, and again, we can get more into the weeds later, is Google goes around the world telling governments, telling everybody that about 2% of search is news related.
Okay, well, how are we defining news related? Because if that's the percent of searches where news articles are some of the top results, 2% sounds way too low.
Right. So that's what Anya thought. And she and a team of researchers expanded this percentage to include the ways that most of us encounter the news on Google.
Mm.
We're not Googling the New York Times. We're asking a question like, has this baby formula brand been recalled? And there's research showing that when there's news in the search results, users spend more time clicking around because the information is good and Google makes money on the ads we see through that extended online journey.
I see.
So Anya took this to a team of economists and asked them to calculate how much more money Google and Facebook make thanks to the presence of news in their platforms, at least in the U.S. And the dollar amount they came up with was huge.
The team of economists came back to me and said, we think Google and Facebook owe U.S. publishers $15 billion a year.
$15
billion? It's a lot. I think it surprised her, too.
And I said, what? That's a huge, huge number. Like, do you mind just looking at that again? And so they kind of went back, crunched again, said, okay, really conservatively, we think it's $13.9 billion. So I was like, okay, I can't believe I'm going out into the world with this huge number because it's so much bigger than anybody else has been able to get.
Wow, that's a lot. So you were saying that all this started when Anya heard that Australia was cutting one of these deals.
Well, just to be clear, the news organizations in Australia negotiate the deals with the tech firms.
And, okay, wait, so what's the government's role?
So the government's passed a type of law that it calls a bargaining code.
A bargaining code?
Yes, the code serves as a sort of set of rules for the negotiations between tech and the news.
Kind of like the rules of engagement.
Exactly.
Okay. And presumably, the bargaining code tries to level the playing field a bit between the news organization and these big, powerful tech companies?
That's the idea.
So how did this pan out for news media companies in Australia?
You know, they actually did pretty well. They got a total of $140 million for various news organizations.
Hmm. So, I mean, that sounds like a lot. Was it a lot?
Well, it's a lot more than they would have gotten otherwise, but it's still probably only a small fraction of what Anya thinks they could probably be paying based on how much Google benefits from news content.
about. We're talking about a huge, huge, huge surplus that news has contributed to, and the money's not being shared. We've switched the discussion from millions to billions, and I think that's actually what happened.
I mean, I'd love some billions. So do we know what kind of effect Anya's research has had so far, if any?
I think her goal is to reframe it towards the type of money that's necessary to actually recapitalize the industry of journalism. You know, these small grants of $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 to news organizations just aren't going to cut it. Mm. But whether bargaining codes are going to rescue journalism, I think it's too soon to say. These kinds of negotiations take a long time, but Anya says people are really interested.
I get email almost every day from all around the world asking for details. So we're doing these pro bono Zooms with loads and loads of countries and publishers and governments. So
I mean, I'm not surprised it's a popular idea. Anyone who cares about journalism as like one of the core components of a functioning democracy is really desperate right now for some solution to keep the news afloat.
Yes, and this is one idea of how to make that happen.
Okay. So, I mean, what are the counterpoints here? Because it does sort of strike me as a little weird for news organizations to get into bed financially with the companies that have been supposedly kind of stealing from them. And do we know the terms of any of these deals?
We don't. They're private.
Hmm. So how do we know that the news organizations that get these big payouts are actually going to spend that money on journalism? I feel like that's just sort of trickle-down economics. And I mean, we have plenty of examples through history showing that big payouts at the top do not filter down to news workers like me. The money stays at the top.
So I'm glad you brought that up because I want to bring in the other voice from the event that the Knight Foundation hosted, Cory Doctorow. Cory wears a lot of hats. He's a science fiction author, an activist, a journalist, a blogger. And a lot of folks know him from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. When I asked Cory what he thought about these negotiations with news organizations and big tech, he started talking about Canada, which just passed its own bargaining code, the Online News Act, this past winter.
So I'm from Canada, and so I follow the Canadian news bargaining code very closely, which is why I was personally very dismayed to see Torstar, our largest news company, which is now owned by a couple of guys who are really into online casinos, take a bunch of money from Google voluntarily. I just don't think that there's an amount of tech money that we could give to Alden Capital that would lead them to rehire the staff that they fired from the Chicago Tribune, nor an amount of money we could give Sinclair that would stop them from turning the Baltimore Sun into a partisan rag. I don't think that if Condé Nast gets into bed with Google and Facebook, that they're going to give us back Pitchfork. Apple has just offered all of the kind of A-list media outlets $50 million apiece to turn over their corpuses. As someone who cares about the news and news workers, I don't see how licensing that material gets the New York Times to not use the resulting model to fire me and replace me with an AI, right? If we think that that's what AI is going to do. So I don't see how creating a regime in which corporations can charge license fees to other corporations, corporations that are insatiably horny for firing their workers, gets us better news or more employment for news workers at all.
So this is a common concern you hear about these news media bargaining code style deals. You know, are we just funneling money into Rupert Murdoch's pocket?
Right.
And it makes sense why you and Cory are skeptical. But at least in the case of Australia, it looks like their deal with the tech firms actually did create some jobs. So Australia's news media bargaining code became law in 2021. And after a year, at least a few big Australian news organizations and some independent newsrooms as well said they had used the money to hire more journalists. And researchers at the Australia Institute saw a 46% increase in job ads for journalists after the deal went into effect. Now, the data aren't entirely clear, but at least that's some indication that things went in the right direction.
Got it.
So one criticism people have of what's happened in Australia is that these negotiations are not transparent. So there's no way to make sure tech companies are paying publishers enough, and there's no way to hold publishers accountable to spend the money in ways that actually benefit journalism.
Or to make sure they don't change their coverage of big tech after making a deal with big tech.
That's right.
So clearly Cory's not a big fan of this plan. Does he have an idea of what we should do instead?
He does. And for him, it starts with transforming the way we're thinking about the problem of big tech stealing from journalism.
Hmm. How so?
Well, first, Corey wants us to think bigger about the market.
I think that, you know, one thing that generally people who show up at a Knight Foundation event about saving the news and saving democracy agree on is that tech is stealing something from the news. But the thing that maybe I disagree with some of you about is what they're stealing, because I don't think they're stealing content. I just think they're stealing money. There's a lot of money disappearing between the cracks that doesn't have to do with a failure to pay licensing fees.
Hmm. Well, if it's not about them stealing content, what are these cracks?
Well, the first one Corey talked about is online advertising.
So take ad revenues, right? Programmatic ads, they're a duopoly. The two companies control the vast majority of that are Google and Meta. They've been caught illegally colluding to rig that market where they raise the price for advertisers, lower the payments to publishers. They provide tools for sellers, which are publishers. They provide buyer tools to advertisers. They run the marketplace where the buyers and the sellers meet. They are also buyers and sellers in that marketplace. So this is like you going through a divorce where you and your partner are both represented by the same lawyer who's also the judge.
Can I just say that happened to me?
We're now going in a different direction with this conversation.
When I saw you had said that in one of the papers, I was like, oh my God.
But was the lawyer also the judge, and was the lawyer also trying to match with both of you on Tinder? And when the divorce was over, did the lawyer own your house?
What? Right?
So that sounds very convoluted.
Right, and I think that's part of the point. But in the end, if you look at the numbers, back in the days of print ads in the newspaper, at least before the 80s, the agencies that sold those ads back in those days got like a 15% commission. But now that agency is Google.
And how much is Google making?
It's at least 30 cents on the dollar, sometimes more. That's according to the Department of Justice, who has an ongoing antitrust case against Google.
That's a pretty big share for a middleman. So this is one of the ways he says big tech is siphoning off money from the news.
Yes, and there's more.
So another way that tech steals money from the news, which is payments. There's another duopoly, Google and Apple, who control mobile payments, and they take 30 cents out of every subscriber dollar, every donation, every time someone buys a tote bag with the name of a news outlet through an app.
Not my tote bag.
Yep.
Wait, so let's just use an example from this morning. On my way over here, I was listening to The Daily, and they had reporters on with their little message saying, hey, you know, if you care about journalism and if you want to support us, please subscribe to The Times. So if I were to do what they said and go on my New York Times app and pay them, say, $50 for my first year, Corey's saying that a third of that, $16, is going to either Apple or Google?
That's what he's saying.
This sounds like a problem not just for newsmakers, but anyone who receives online payments. So, like, any business.
That's right. And there's another antitrust case against Apple for exactly that reason.
So, Corey's given us two big places where money for journalism is falling through the cracks.
Yes, and there's one more.
And there's a third way that tech steals money from the news media, and that's blackmail. So the platforms make this promise to their users. They say, come onto our platform, tell us who matters to you, and we'll show you what they post. So news entities show up on the platforms, they put a lot of energy into cultivating audiences, and then the platforms turn around and they say, actually, we're not going to deliver the media to the people who asked to see it unless you pay us to boost or to authenticate, and this is a rolling and recurring payment.
Wait a second. Is this like now you have to buy a blue checkmark on X?
Yes, and the tech platforms have created other schemes by which news organizations have to compete to get visibility.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because I've noticed lately that the only way I have received the news on Facebook or Instagram is when it's an ad, you know, presumably paid for by The Atlantic or New York Magazine.
That's right, and it makes sense. Some of these biggest publishers, like New York Magazine, they pay social marketing firms to help them buy and target Instagram and Facebook ads.
So it sounds like the only way to survive in big tech's world is to act more like big tech, or at least embed yourself deeper into their business model.
Yeah, and I suppose that's not just specific to journalism. Look, a lot of people out there are pissed at big tech firms. you know, they've been called to testify before Congress. They're getting sued by the DOJ. They're getting investigated in Europe. Other places like the UK are passing new laws to try to hold them to account. The problem is way bigger than just the news. And Corey says that's actually a good thing.
We can hitch the news's wagon to big political currents that are much larger than the constituencies who care about news. I admit that I'm one of the weirdos who cares about the news, so are you, but we should admit that we are not a mass movement in the way that people who care about, say, payments are. Fortnite players are a much larger constituency who are worried about payments than everybody who reads the news, including the people who just do the Wordle.
So Corey wants the news to forge an alliance with Fortnite players?
Sort of. He's pointed out a bunch of big changes people are already pushing for that will help the news recoup some of that lost revenue. Mm. One of those changes is comprehensive online privacy laws. And another big one is breaking up big tech's various monopolies.
And so this is why all over the world, there is a movement to break up the ad tech platforms. And here, that movement is extremely bipartisan. How bipartisan is it? The America Act, which will break up Meta and Google, is co-sponsored by Elizabeth Warren and Ted Cruz. Right.
And I assume this will help publishers keep more of the money that advertisers pay to post ads.
Right. That's 30 cents on the dollar. So news publishers would get to keep more of that dollar.
Got it.
So Corey's last proposal has to do with how the news shows up on social media platforms.
When people sign up for social media, they don't get the stuff that they ask to see so that the platforms can charge the people who publish the things they ask to see ransom to show it to them.
Right. That's one of the reasons publishers say they're losing money right now, that there's been changes to algorithms that are actually downranking the news.
Correct. And like we mentioned earlier, sometimes the platforms do this, then turn around and ask you to pay them to quote unquote boost your content. So Corey says you can address this by barring platforms from tinkering with their algorithms in ways that hide content that users say they want to see. And this is in line with so-called net neutrality laws, which make it illegal to use your position as an internet provider to negatively manipulate people's online experience in a way that makes you more money.
Like slowing down the internet when users go on a competitor's website?
Exactly. It would treat these social media companies the same way, telling them you can't make it harder for people to see the stuff they want to see. So these solutions Corey's suggesting are already popular.
Yeah, I mean, if Liz Warren and Ted Cruz agree on it, that's pretty impressive. So moving back to Anya and this idea of negotiating payouts between big tech and news orgs, what does she think of what Corey's saying here?
I think she agrees with Corey that the problems he's describing are real and that they're also a major threat to news and journalism.
But Corey's also arguing that accepting money from big tech is still problematic.
Right. And I think Anya agrees there are problems with bargaining codes, but she says at least some of those can be addressed within the codes themselves.
We really think that these codes have to include small outlets, and we want a commitment that the money is going to be spent on journalism, and we want diversity. And I was never, by the way, you know, when I first started looking at this in 2020, I wasn't like some huge advocate. You know, I'm not saying that I'm like the bargaining code girl. I'm saying that right now it's something in front of us that's transferring money from big tech to outlets, and I think that's a good thing.
So what I'm hearing is kind of a pragmatic argument, like news outlets are dying today, and this gives them an injection of money, like right now. So what does Corey say to all this?
His response is that even though it seems like the changes he's pushing for are huge and unattainable, they're actually just as achievable as these new bargaining code laws.
So I think that there's an implicit idea that fixing ads or payments or fixing these ransom payments for reaching subscribers, that these are big lifts that require a long run-up and that are kind of quixotic quests. And my argument is that these are immediate issues of moment for groups of people who are larger and more powerful than the press, and that if the press wants to get the biggest bang for its buck, it should be joining forces on these issues that are not just the parochial interests of the press, but the broad interests of the public around the world.
I just don't see why he doesn't think we can have both. Like, why can't the news pursue these short-term deals with big tech as a matter of survival and keep pushing long-term for broader regulation of these big monopolistic tech giants?
That's a question that some other people asked that night why can't we have both? I think Corey's concern is about the ethics of the thing.
So I think the problem of selling indulgences is well studied, and it's been studied for 500 years, right?
Wait, 500 years of what?
I think he's talking about the Catholic Church.
Oh, okay. Keep going, Corey.
If you want to extinguish conduct, you shouldn't tax it, you should prohibit it. And I think that the conduct that we need to extinguish here is not indexing the news. I think the conduct we need to extinguish is taking the money.
So we didn't necessarily solve this debate that night.
And didn't?
No, and I have to say, I haven't solved it in my own mind. I think that on some level, I see the urgency of trying to get dollars into the hands of news organizations now, even as I see it as a very urgent thing to try to remake the market. But stepping down from all the kind of, I suppose, strategic level of things there, how's this landing for you, Rebecca? I want to come back to you as the journalist coming out of graduate school. You're looking for work right now.
Yeah. So on one hand, I mean, I'm ready to accept any solution. Like, I'm not going to say, I don't want your blood money. But I do wonder how much of this money I'm ever going to see. Like, if the news accepts these sorts of payouts from big tech, it might, in the short term, relieve just enough pressure, especially at the top of these organizations, for us to stop fighting so hard against the real root of the problem, which is that big tech has too much power. They can shut off the news in Australia, Canada, California. So one thing I want to ask you is, why are big tech companies fighting this so hard? I mean, I think about Google and Meta, and, you know, from my perspective, they have so much money. Isn't a few hundred million dollars, like, no big deal?
It's a few hundred million times the number of years the deal lasts, times every new country that adopts one of these codes.
Okay.
But you're right, they probably could afford at least some of it in some markets. Everyone's got their own theory on why big tech fights back so hard against laws that appear to be in the public interest. And I suppose we can't know for sure until we actually talk to folks at Google or Meta. But many folks in the tech policy world, including Anya, say that the big tech companies have drunk their own Kool-Aid.
And what Kool-Aid is that?
It's sort of the idea of the free internet, that information should be free for all, no copyrights or licensing getting in the way.
Except please let me profit from it at every step of the way.
Well, you know, especially with the advent of AI, you know, they want to be able to train these AI models on vast quantities of text, every book, every blog, every news article ever written. If they had to pay for all that, you know, the game would be over. And we haven't really talked about all the ways that AI is going to change the market for information and for news in terms of both how journalists produce information and publish it and how it's monetized. The deck seems really stacked in favor of big tech in the long run, and they're more or less just doing the exact same thing they've been doing for the last two decades when it comes to negotiating with news organizations.
You bringing up AI is making me think about something I read recently from a tech reporter, Cade Metz. He pointed out that a problem these companies are actually running into with developing these AIs is that they're actually running out of real-world data to feed the model.
That's right. They're starting to turn to synthetic data.
Oh, God. But if big tech companies want to pursue better and better AI, shouldn't they want to make sure that there are people out there, like, I don't know, journalists, generating all of that tasty content to feed the AI?
One would think, and I think they want journalism to exist. You know, Google and Meta go around and give money to journalism. We're starting to see OpenAI do deal after deal with journalism organizations.
Right. And, you know, I think the school we're sitting in right now got some Zuckerberg money.
It got some Zuckerberg money and more recently some Microsoft money associated with AI.
And I'm pretty sure, you know, they're partnering up with the Google News Initiative as well. So we're happy to take whatever we can get over here. But again, is that just to appease news organizations?
Maybe. But I think they also may realize they need news for the reasons you just said. It's just that the status quo and the imbalance of power between tech and news, with journalism organizations kind of limping along half dead, that's working out just fine for them.
Yeah. And you know, actually, the great journalist Jon Stewart, I was watching, he brought on the FTC chair, Lina Khan, on The Daily Show. And he was talking about AI and how these monopolistic type activities are already happening with these big tech companies and AI. And she said something that really struck me.
I mean, going back all the way to the founding, there was a recognition that in the same way that you need the Constitution to create checks and balances in our political sphere,
right,
you also needed the antitrust and anti-monopoly laws to safeguard against concentration of economic power, because you don't want an autocrat of trade in the same way that you don't want a monarch.
I was really stunned by that phrase, autocrat of trade. And like you, I'm not really sure what the solution is here. You know, it feels like America is grappling with the threat of autocracy from so many angles. And it seems that journalism has placed itself right into the center of that fight.
Well, I suppose that's where it's supposed to be on some level. But what a time and a way for you to start a career.
That's right. Here's hoping I'll actually have one.
Rebecca, thanks again. I'm really glad to have your perspective in this conversation as someone who's just starting out.
Thanks. I'm actually really glad I got to learn about all of this. And, you know, it's looking grim out there, but I'm glad that people care about the news, even if Corey will call all of us weirdos.
Let's go make some more muffins.
Yeah.
Policy Press.